There are just a few things in life that reliably put my back up, and one of them is modern jazz. But I'm going to set aside my prejudices for half an hour, because today's subject is, I'm told, perhaps the greatest jazz saxophonist of all time, and arguably jazz's last great superstar, guru of the jazz avant-garde. His name was John Coltrane, and his album Giant Steps was recorded exactly 50 years ago, in May 1959. My guest, who's chosen Coltrane, is well placed to explain the appeal. Andy Shepherd is one of this country's few leading international jazz musicians. His first appearance was playing saxophone here in Bristol with a quartet called Sphere, since when he's played and collaborated all over the world. Andy, you were just 2 years old when Giant Steps was released, but I'm reliably told that you can still remember the first time you heard him.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's just fantastic. Whenever I listen to Coltrane, I'm uplifted. But it's more than the saxophone, you know. And I also have a problem with jazz. You know, this word jazz is a difficult four-letter word. But what I really, really love is music with the utmost integrity, passion, love. And the great thing about jazz music or improvised music, whatever you want to call it, is that the music starts inside the performer. Straight to you, if you've got the ears to receive it. And Coltrane is a sublime example of the heights of creative playing for me, you know, and everyone should have Coltrane in their ears all the time.
How old were you when you first heard him?
Well, I came to him late, you know, but it was a kind of revelation because I met a jazz musician. I was on my way to art college, so I just kind of left school. He knew I was a musician.
You'd have been about 19, I
guess. Yeah, and, you know, I bumped into a jazz piano player, fantastic musician, Jeff Williams, and he was the guy who said, you know, you're a musician, you're not an artist. You should be playing an instrument. Have you heard Charles Mingus and John Coltrane? And I was aware of Miles Davis, and I was listening to a lot of music, and I sung when I was in a choir when I was a kid, you know, so I was full of music, but I hadn't heard the real thing, you know. And he kind of said, you know, you need to smoke this and listen to this, you know. And within minutes, Coltrane was just right into me, you know, and I thought, I understand this. And I sold everything I owned, bought a saxophone, and became totally addictive.
So it really is him that set you off.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wanted to play the saxophone when I was 12 or so, and I was told at school, you can't do that. You need to play the clarinet first, and all this kind of rubbish, you know, and I should have. And then I never ever studied music at all. I'm still building up to my first saxophone lesson, actually, you know, because when you discover the world of Coltrane, and it's all there, you just need to have the ears, and then you start to study. There's only 12 notes in silence, and the more you listen to truly great musicians, the more you grow, and the more you play with them, the more you grow.
And it just set you on fire.
It did, absolutely. Yeah, I thought, I understand this music. Why haven't I heard it before? It's kind of hidden away from you.
You say, why hadn't you heard it before? And you say you knew about people like Miles Davis. Coltrane, not so well known. Why is that?
Well, jazz, in that word again. You know, the music is still, to this day, it's not on the radio. I was so thrilled about coming to talk about Coltrane that I turned up a day early for this program. You know, I mean, it's anything that gets... Because somebody's going to listen to this and it might enter into their consciousness, oh, there's this guy, John Coltrane. Oh, there's this world of music that, you know, I knew kind of existed, but I'd never really begun to understand it before. And then you realise that this music is so important. It influences all other music. It's a bit like, you know, the Impressionist movement in art or something. These are the people that were the original innovators.
There's something so extraordinary about him that he actually started a church, or rather a church was started, the Church of St. John Coltrane. How seriously do you take all that?
Yeah, that, I have a little problem with the Church of Jean-Claude. It's a very Californian thing.
Yeah.
You know, I've been to California. I know what
I've
goes on.
I've been looking at pictures of it.
No, but it's... he did have a kind of, you know, epiphany and became religious. But, you know, the thing is, music is God. Creativity is... It's all... You know, we all have a little bit of God in all of us. And the problem comes when people write a book about it or build a building and say, you know, God is... this, you know, but Coltrane was the top guy, and then it's been twisted around into a church of, you know, I don't know what all that's about.
All subjects I want to get back to, because we've got with us Tony Harrington, who's editor-in-chief of The Wire. Tony, you reckon that Coltrane's importance isn't just as a jazz musician, but maybe as the founder of what later became known as world music?
Yeah, well, Coltrane... from a very early stage, I was both exposed to and interested in not just jazz, but rhythmic ideas from African music, from Brazil and Cuba. He became a professional musician in Philadelphia in the late 40s, and there was a big Latin community in Philadelphia at that time. And Coltrane's first significant professional engagement with Dizzy Gillespie's big band in the late 40s, well, Gillespie also was a popularizer of Latin rhythms, introducing Latin rhythms into popular American music. From there, Coltrane started introducing scales from India, Arabic music, Japan. And it all kind of came together in what became known as sort of a universal music or cosmic music. Getting back to Andy's dislike of the word jazz, certainly by the mid-60s, when Coltrane was kind of at his height, jazz was a word that was not really being used or applied to this kind of music. And you have to suspend your cynicism a bit with Coltrane, because all the music, he talked about it in deeply spiritual terms. Likewise, his followers did, pushing it to the extreme where they actually went and formed the church in his name. Although the church didn't actually worship Coltrane. It was a Christian church. Basically, the services at the church were conducted using his music.
And he was a saint in Panoply, I think.
That's right, yeah. Saint John Will I Am Coltrane, as they refer to him. I mean, and there's in Japan in 1966, the Coltrane's group toured Japan in 1966, where they were greeted as conquering heroes. You know, the story is that they came out of the plane, and there was a red carpet rolled out, and they were wondering who this was for. Thousands of people on the tarmac, a bit like the Beatles arriving at JFK. And they didn't realise who it was for until they saw all these cardboard cutouts of the group members, and it was for them. And Coltrane was asked, I think there was an interview done at the airport, and one of the Japanese interviewers asked him, what do you want to be in 10 years' time? And Coltrane actually said, I want to be a saint. And it was all a part of his idea of music being a universal experience, a cosmic experience, which could get to people on a very deep and profound level.
Well, we've already flagged up some extraordinary outposts of a really extraordinary life. And before we embark on the details of his life, I'd just like to play a piece of archive from one of his early associates, Jimmy Heath, another saxophonist, about the condition of John Coltrane's teeth.
Yeah, he had a lot of problems with nerves in the two front teeth and the top. Nerves or something were close to the surface, and it used to hurt and tinge when he played, so he put bicycle tire patch on the top of the mouthpiece, a rubber, and it sort of alleviated some of the pain for a while. Then he went through a lot of getting different kinds of teeth, of caps put on his teeth, and I know one set he had that looked like horse teeth. And he took those back and had those taken and got another set. But he did have a problem with the nerves in his teeth, and he said it used to hurt a lot.
You know, he had a very addictive personality, but I think that the teeth thing came about through an addiction to sweets more than harder drugs.
Mints, particularly, apparently.
You know, you've got to suffer for your art. I mean, what can I say?
Well, you can tell us. Is it true that what people say, that he sucked so many mints that the keys of the saxophone got jammed up with congealed sugar? Can that happen?
That does happen. I mean, the saxophone is this extraordinary... I mean, it's made of brass, pigskin, and bamboo. You know, bamboo is the reed that you get the sound from, which is great, actually, because it's kind of, when you think about it, you know, when we were all living in caves, some of the first instruments we used were bamboo flutes. Yeah, if you, if you drink a lot of whiskey, or the molecules from what you're drinking or eating do go down the tube and will stick. You know, you do get a problem with pads sticking, but there are ways to alleviate that with these days, you know, a little bit of silicone.
Tell us, Tony, in what circumstances and where was he born, the early years of his life?
Well, he was born in North Carolina in September 1926, and by all accounts, he was born into a fairly middle-class black family, as much as a black family in North Carolina in the 20s could be middle-class. Obviously, it was the time of segregation.
But not the sort of abject poverty that a lot of black musicians...
That kind of came later, but basically his father was a tailor. Both his parents played instruments informally at home. His father played violin, his mother played piano. Both of his grandfathers were Methodist preachers. One of them, Coltrane himself, referred to as being fairly militant, which meant he was basically involved in local black community politics.
Yeah.
And at school, he was a fairly an exceptional pupil. You know, he was a studious and so on. I think the first major event in his life was when his father died at age of 13. Mm. And at the same time, there were some other deaths in the family, and effectively left the family being just Coltrane, his mother, and a cousin called Mary. This was around about the time that he also started playing music. I think he started playing a clarinet at age about 13, I think. Right from the get-go, he was plunged into this thing. He completely dived into music, practicing obsessively and compulsively, even at that early stage.
Quite a fine-looking man, Andy, from the pictures that I've seen, with a very sensitive face.
Oh, yeah. I think he used to go up and down. Maybe that's something to do with his suits. So his weight used to... didn't he have two sets of suits, you know, depending on his... But, you know, the funny thing about... Well, it's not funny, is that I can't imagine John Coltrane doing anything other than playing the saxophone. Mm. You know, I can sing about Miles Davis driving his Ferrari. Coltrane, I just... it's fascinating for me to hear a bit about his early life stuff, because he's the man, you know, with the horn, the music, pouring out this non-stop... You know, he'd practice between sets in clubs, probably drive everyone crazy. And he did so much in such a short time.
He didn't talk a lot about himself, Tony. Can you give us any account of how the passion was first born in him and also how he first got noticed?
Well, his most recent biographer, Lewis Porter, speculates quite extensively on the effect that the death of his father and his paternal and maternal grandfathers had on him. It's possibly a slightly too pat explanation, but Porter maintains that Coltrane poured himself into music as a way of replacing the vacuum left by all these deaths in the family. But I think basically he's speculating, because there's no obvious reason why Coltrane was so consumed by music and became so passionate about it, where, as Andy said, it was like the only thing you can imagine Coltrane doing is actually playing.
How do you know you're good in this business, Andy? Will he just have had an innate sense of his own talent, or will people have told him? What brings someone on?
I think the constant practicing did pay off. I mean, that giant steps thing we listed at the beginning of the programme is an extraordinary tour de force and improvising. And he's almost like thinking in three dimensions. It sounds exuberant and easy, and it's flowing and full of ideas, and it's melodic and full of energy. But what he's doing and what he's improvising on in such a free-flowing way is an incredibly complex chord sequence, you know. So, and other people would try and play those changes, and it would just be a sticky mess, you know. And I'm sure he must have known something happens when you play music, you know, something very special, you know, with great players happens in the room when you're listening to them, or, you know, through recordings in the case of Coltrane.
And do you know it? Do you know it when it's happening to you? Are you thinking, hey, this is genius, hey, I'm a genius?
Absolutely. You know, and what I love with music, live music, is that, you know, I want to be thrilled and I want unexpected things to happen. I don't want to listen to a band and know what's going to happen next.
Coltrane wasn't a prodigy, I think, which is interesting. If you hear quotes from his contemporaries from when he was a teenager into his 20s, no one talks about him as having this blinding talent. He didn't develop as an isolated genius.
Yeah.
He developed very much as part of a community of musicians.
Is that also where the drugs started, that community?
Yeah, well, we were talking about his dental problems earlier, and he did. He basically had an addiction to sweets coupled with a profound fear of dentists, which meant he suffered with quite severe toothache for most of his life. Mm. So that was one reason why he started drinking. And heroin, for instance, was a drug that was there on the scene. But it had also already become part of the mythology of jazz. When Coltrane started playing professionally in the late 40s, the most significant figure in jazz was Charlie Parker, who had emerged a few years earlier to absolutely revolutionise jazz, not just saxophone playing, but the entirety of jazz. And Charlie Parker was notoriously a figure who could take any drug going, he would drink and so on. And the fact that, you know, it was well known that Parker was a junkie, and this became part of the mythology of jazz.
He was a junkie in the end, wasn't he, Coltrane?
He was, yeah, absolutely.
The problem was that they were getting strung out on heroin. And the problem with that is that you become addicted, and then you need to feed the habit and all the things that go with it.
Listen to this description from the writer Bill Cole. When I first saw him in the fall of 1955 in Miles Davis's band, he was almost unknown. He would step into the foreground when he and Miles played the line of a piece, and then, during Miles's improvisation, he would stand far off to the side, in the background, usually watching the chords. He wore, as he did throughout most of his life, inconspicuous clothes, usually a dark or grey suit. He looked worn and thin, and his clothes almost hang on him. But Train was inconspicuous only until he picked up his horn and started to play.
Fantastic. There's a funny, I mean, you know, very well-known quote of Miles. Because Coltrane, when he did start to play, he would never stop. You know, it was like a flow of ideas. And he did ask Miles, and so he didn't know how to end his... So, and Miles just said, take the thing out of your mouth.
You know? It didn't say thing, actually. It was a mother something or other. Yeah.
There were a few clips, film clips of him playing. And I remember when I first saw them being kind of disappointed, because you want this sort of charisma to... You want almost some kind of light to beam out of the screen to sort of, you know, affirm your belief that this man was somehow possessed of supernatural powers.
And it doesn't come through
the
celluloid.
Come through. By all accounts, Coltrane was a very humble man. He was very self-effacing. He was very generous. He was not selfish. Even at the height of his heroin habit, the story goes that he was sufficiently together and had a sense of responsibility to his family, where he put a deposit down on a house in Philadelphia and maintained the mortgage payments so that his mother and cousin could live there. That quote we just heard, where he's talked about he only came alive when he stepped with the mic and started playing, I think that absolutely fits with people's description of him. He was someone who absolutely didn't look for the limelight. He wasn't a Miles Davis. He didn't drive around with Lamborghinis and so on. He did not turn up at nightclubs with beautiful women on his arm. And I think that partly is maybe one reason why he's not as famous as Miles, for instance.
You're listening to Great Lives, and Andy Shepherd is promoting the cause of John Coltrane. Also here in the studio is Tony Harrington of The Wire. And before we go on, I'd just like to play a montage of voices that agree with both of your points of view.
It satisfies on so many different levels.
It sort of blossomed.
Intellectually.
I thought he was an angel from heaven.
Spiritually.
I might say he was an incarnation of Lord Krishna, the Gana Gana Nila, the Yedu Nandana, the beautiful blue-black mind-enchanting player of the flute.
Emotionally.
That's what music is about.
Musically.
Active listening does something to you.
Poetically.
Buckle your seats. Here we go.
Open your eyes now, Andy. Tell me about that piece of music.
Well, it's incredible. You know, I'm engaged with it immediately. The sound, the feeling that he's searching for something, and you're right there with him in that moment. It's being played for the first time. It's kind of, it's just wonderful. So it's real music. We need more of that. Play some more. You don't need me talking. Let's listen to Coltrane.
And that's after he's kicked the heroin habit. He went through serious cold turkey, didn't he?
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that's the, you know, the sleeve notes are the full-on kind of finding God thing, you know, and the chant, and actually it's really beautiful when he gets to this chant, "I Love Supreme," in the middle of the record. It's a very profound, it's just this voice, "I Love Supreme, I Love Supreme." It's, you know, it's a mantra-like thing, but it's not embarrassing, or it's not, you know, it's kind of, it's great.
According to Coltrane himself, and this is taken from the liner notes to his album, "A Love Supreme," "During the year of 1957, I experienced, by the grace of God, a spiritual awakening which was to lead me to a richer, fuller, more productive life. At that time, in gratitude, I humbly asked to be given the means and privilege to make others happy through music. I feel this has been granted through his grace. All praise to God." Was he religious in the conventional sense, Tony? I know both of you find this religious side a bit of a distraction, but it wasn't for him.
Well, speaking as a confirmed atheist, it doesn't get in the way of my appreciation of the music or my understanding of the significance of it. But he wasn't religious in the conventional sense. His spirituality was syncretic, like his music was. So going hand
syncretic
in hand...
Syncretic meaning?
An amalgamation of lots of different beliefs.
Yeah.
So sort of picking magpie-like, if you like, from various different belief systems. Like he did with music. So he was drawing from lots of different forms of music, Indian music, Arabic music, and so on. And he was interested in Buddhism, in Islam, in Japanese religions, and so on. So he would conflate all these spiritual ideas into one... He was spiritual, not religious.
It's
a very significant difference, I think.
Yeah, and I find, you know, when I'm playing and it's going well, what's going on is almost, it's coming through you. You're not thinking. That's the whole thing with this music, is that if you start thinking about what you're doing, you're not in the moment anymore. You think when you practice. You know, you think about harmonic things and sound and studying a piece of music, but when you're in the act of actually performing, of playing, of really playing, you're not thinking. You're in a kind of state of mind which is just banging the moment.
I do know what you mean, and oddly enough, it doesn't happen to me in my trade, which is writing, which is a fairly hack sort of thing to do, but I've sometimes felt it long distance running. There are just those moments when you feel inhabited in some way. I can't really use any other description.
Yeah, and I also feel that practicing this, an instrument, is in a way a kind of meditative process. You know, if you're really practicing and concentrating the mind, it kind of, after you've been playing for an hour or something, you stop and you realize an hour's gone by. It's like you kind of feel really refreshed afterwards because you've stopped your mind from the usual, you know, mess that's going on, jumble of ideas, and you're just way into your music.
We have here an interesting couple of pieces of archive. Firstly, his pianist McCoy Tyner talking in 2006 on Radio 3, followed by his producer talking about how he used to record him at all times of night and day.
He was, I wouldn't say a very religious man, but he was a very spiritual person. And we both had mothers that exposed us to some sort of belief and faith in God, and my mother was like that. She wasn't persistent and constantly gnawing at you or anything like that, but she just wanted you to know what that was about. And I think it was the same in his situation. So I wasn't surprised at all when he dedicated that piece of music to the Supreme. I thought it was great, you know, and he really wanted to do it, and you could hear it in his sound and in his conviction he had was ever present.
I felt after getting to know him that when he had a desire to just record, we should just go ahead and record and put it away if necessary. I've had my problems with the record company because they didn't understand why I was constantly recording him. And I remember in those days, I tried to schedule all recording at night so it wouldn't even be discussed during the day. And we'd all shoot out to Rudy Van Gelder's in New Jersey and record late at night. And then I would catch hell, you know, the next day, but at least I'd get the recording down.
Tony, people have said that Coltrane took jazz to places it had never been before. And later, in his career, he almost took it off the map, or he took it off the mental or aesthetic maps of people like me, so that there were people that would actually walk out of jazz performances. What was going on?
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, there are also, against that, there are also testaments to his audiences at the time responding as if they were at, like, a Baptist revival meeting. People would be responding as if they were, you know, as if he was speaking in tongues and they were feeling the spirit, for instance. And some of that does come across on record. Obviously, you don't get the full impact, but you can hear that. You can hear that energy, that ecstasy, I think. But I think it all basically comes down to this constant wanting to, as Andy said, sort of evolve the music, to push it forward. He was basically building again. He didn't want, as I said earlier, he could have rested back on his laurels and just coasted for the rest of his life. As it turned out, it was a very short life, but he didn't do that. He basically formed a new group, and he was pushing out. And in that process of exploration and search, the music became ever more intense and certainly not impenetrable, but certainly it created great demands on the listener, and there were obviously less people around who were willing to meet those demands, if you like.
Well, Andy, Tony says that he could have rested on his laurels. Other people might say he could have carried on playing things that people understood and wanted to listen to, but he led the music off into a wilderness. I know you don't like the word jazz, but is there a sense in which Coltrane killed jazz?
Oh, no, not at all, no. Absolutely the opposite, you know, because I don't always want to listen to the out stuff. You know, it is tough, you know. You have to be in a certain state of mind. It'll ruin your dinner party, you know. But there's one record which is just stunningly beautiful and always works for me, and that's the Ballads record, where he's playing these fantastic tunes, but the way he plays the tunes and what he does with one or two notes, he just changes one or two things. It's just fantastic.
He died in 1967, aged 40, of a liver complaint. I think physically he had destroyed himself, hadn't he?
It was actually cancer of the liver, by all accounts. And yes, he may have had hepatitis, which may have been brought on by his heroin use. He had a severe weight problem, which also may have exacerbated the illness. It was diagnosed very late. If it had been diagnosed earlier, it could have been cured by surgery, perhaps. But it was very quick.
I'd like one day to sit down and look at the discography, you know, and to see how quickly all those records followed one another, because it is extraordinary that, you know, in 59 is giant steps and, you know, 67 he's gone, and yet there's this an amazing amount of recorded material, and it's diverse and it's evolving and it's, you know, it's quite, he must have been, well, he was playing all the time, didn't take the thing out of his mouth.
You've been listening to Great Lives. My thanks to Andy Shepherd, who chose our great life, John Coltrane, and to our expert witness, Tony Harrington. Goodbye.